Very good. Here we go. The first question time. So please sit comfortably. It's been a long day for some of you. See what we have here. The first one here, they say, Dear Ajahn, despite chanting Pirit and some meditation before going to sleep, I am troubled by dreams. Nothing of any significance, just rubbish. How can I get better, more refreshing sleep? For those of you who do have very nasty dreams or bad dreams, please leave a piece of paper by your bedside and write them down afterwards when you wake up, and that could be a great script for another movie. Because they're running out of ideas for movies, and you could make a lot of money that way. But if it's just rubbish dreams, sometimes it just means there's too much rubbish being going on during the daytime, and it just comes out at night time. So one of the best ways is just having, being in the present moment as much as you can during the day, and being kind during the day. And then, you have that same kindness and present moment in your dreams as well. You have kind dreams and fun dreams instead of like nasty dreams. And sometimes your dreams can be good fun. I was telling a few of the monks the other day, last week, the week before, one of my favorite dreams which I can remember is having this psychic battle with this Hindu. We were flying through the air in one of my dreams, zapping each other, and it was really good fun. Of course, it was my dream, so I won. Those sort of neat dreams. So if you do lots of meditation, you can have some really fun dreams. They're like psychic battles with other people. But whatever. As long as you keep a positive mind during the daytime, you have a positive mind during the nighttime. You take into sleep what you bring into sleep. So, chanting Pirit is the chanting which we do, meditation before going to sleep. One of the best meditations is loving kindness meditation, just kindness. Kindness to your body, kindness to your pillow, kindness to your bed. And if you do that little bit of kindness before you go to bed, you usually have very, very kind dreams, if any dreams at all. If you have lots of dreams, that most of the very strong dreams, the ones you remember, usually occur just before you wake up. And it's usually a sign that you are sleeping too much. Your brain is active, but you've still got your eyes closed. So, maybe just try getting up a tiny bit earlier. But it doesn't matter, it's only dreams, good dreams, bad dreams. Leave them in your sleep. Don't linger in the past when you wake up in the morning, and that way, that if you do have a bad dream or a good dream, it just stays in the bed. You don't take it out with you afterwards. But if you have had a bad dream, or if you have had a bad night's sleep, and you wake up really grumpy, and you go into your bathroom and you look in the mirror, you should do the exercise which a couple of monks reminded me of yesterday, the 20 push-ups. Did you exercise in the morning? Do 20 push-ups when you first get up. Not the ordinary push-ups which make too much noise. My 20 push-ups. You get the camera ready for my 20 push-ups. Stand in front of the mirror. Maybe your feet may be about 2 foot apart. And look into the mirror and take your fingers on the edge of the mouth. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I call that 20 push-ups. So learn how to smile. And also you make a silly face at yourself in the mirror, which means you laugh at yourself. And as many people know, I mentioned it in one of the books, that laughter in the first thing in the morning by deliberately smiling at yourself just starts the day better than a cup of coffee. Just go into the mirror, make a funny face in the mirror, smile. The person in the mirror is smiling, you smile more, the person in the mirror smiles more, and you end up laughing. I did that for 2 years when I was a student. Every morning, even though, you know, those were times I was not keeping my precepts. Sometimes you'd be drunk the night before, and you get up, oh God, what have I got to do today? Look in the mirror, oh jeez. And then you just force a smile. And then the guy in the mirror says a little smile, a more smile. Every morning for 2 years, I started the day laughing. So if nothing else works, try that. Look in the mirror. 1, 2, 3. You usually don't get up to 20. After 3 or 4, it's just a stupid thing to do. You end up laughing at yourself. Next question. This is a very profound one. Why is the teddy bear in this meditation hall? Does it have a special meaning? Or Ajahn Brahm just likes a teddy bear. See that teddy bear? That hasn't moved since the start of this retreat. That is called samadhi, stillness. That teddy bear is in jhana. Look, it doesn't feel anything. Now, I might as well introduce teddy bear meditation. But teddy bear meditation, for those of you who are finding it difficult to meditate, you know, sometimes, you know, after the first day, second day, you're ready to go home. So what to do? You can do teddy bear meditation. Teddy bear meditation, you get the teddy bear, you put it on your lap, put your, here we can have a camera shot, and put your hands in front of it, and then start meditating with the teddy bear in your lap, cuddling it. I already mentioned to you that it's so important to have kindness in your meditation. And for some of you, it's so difficult to do, to get that kindness. So ever since about a year and a half ago in Hong Kong, they introduced teddy bear meditation. And one of the guys, you know, who bought, I think it was here about 2 or 3 years ago, but in Hong Kong he bought 2 teddy bears, and those teddy bears were always in use for 9 days. Always somebody had them, sitting on their lap, cuddling it, and then meditating. You find your meditation goes much, much better, much deeper. Simply because it just reminds you of just simple kindness and softness. You're not so forceful with the way you use your attention on your mind. And just the whole attitude. Oh, not another camera shot. No, teddy bear's shy. This is crazy stuff. Hi. So what this actually does is actually enhance your meditation. So we leave it on here. Give it a try. Everyone, at least once during this retreat, try teddy meditation. And even at night time, if it's after the talk, you can take it back to your room with you. And for that person who said they had, despite chanting Purit and some meditation before going to sleep, I'm troubled by dreams. Take this and tuck it up next to you when you go to sleep tonight. And you will have wonderful dreams, nice, kind, peaceful dreams. Because it's a symbol of compassion and kindness and softness and safety. And it's using that to do nice meditation. So I'll leave it here, and if anybody wants to try meditating with it, you know, you can have to be very quick to be the first to get the teddy bear. Dear Ajahn, how to overcome the emotional pain of habitual I'm not good enough or I'm not deserving enough thinking? Well, first of all, be honest. It's quite clear you're not good enough. You're not deserving. If you write a question like that, you know you don't deserve to be. You're not good enough or not deserving enough thinking. It's always because of some conditioning in the past. So in order to realize you are good enough, you have to deliberately bring up all your wonderful qualities. So this is just a simple trick to do, but you have to do it. So whoever wrote this, I'm ordering you, if you want to get rid of this problem, ordering you, get a piece of paper, put your name on the top, draw a vertical line down the middle. On the left-hand side, put all the reasons why you aren't good enough. why you're not deserving enough. Write it down on the left-hand side, why you are not good enough. And then when you finish that left-hand side, on the right-hand side, write down all the reasons why you are good enough. Even if it takes twice, three times, four times as long, write it down, why I am good enough. And then cut that piece of paper down the middle, the left-hand side why you're not good enough, throw it away, incinerate it, flush it down the toilet, whatever it is, and the right-hand side why you are good enough. Put that in your pocket, in your purse, you know, by your bedside, wherever it is, to keep reconditioning yourself that you are good enough. When you see all your good qualities, then you realize, hey, my goodness, I am good enough. It's always interesting for me as a teacher who doesn't just teach lay people but trains monks. When we get the monks to give the talk for the first time, they are stunned after they give their first talk. Hey, people actually listened. They didn't walk out the door. And especially when you say to those monks or those nuns when they give their first talk, hey, that was really profound, really good. They come back to me and they say, these lay people are crazy. They like what I said. They thought what I said was profound. Because it's amazing how people don't think they're good enough. And a little bit of reinforcement, positive reinforcement by that, and then the monks and the nuns who give new talks, they realize, wow, I am good enough after all. And you will all get the chance, because usually the last, well, we finish on Sunday. The last Saturday night, not to like a week today, the last night before the end of the retreat, all the questions will be answered by the young monks, especially Kina Bija, who's a novice, and the two nuns here. So you have to answer, so don't escape. You can't be sick. You can't sort of hide in your rooms. I got the master key. I can open every room in this place. You're going to have to come out and answer the questions. And it's really good fun when you ask the questions, not just of me, but of all the other people who have been meditating here over the week. And it's good for them too, because they realize, wow, you know, they actually do know something, and they're profound. And they can realize, hey, surprise, surprise, I am good enough after all. So, number two, if you really think you are absolutely hopeless, if you think you really are not good enough in life, if you think you are what I call damaged goods because of something which happened to you in the past, then I invite you to have a walk through the forest and try and find for me a perfect tree. If you can find a perfect tree in this forest, you'll be the first person to do so. All the trees in this forest are all bent and crooked, with branches fallen off, with brown and yellow leaves all over the place, with scars and wounds in the bark. There isn't one tree in this forest which is absolutely perfect. The only place you can find a perfect tree is in a government-run plantation. And if you want to go for a picnic or a nice walk, do you like going through plantations? Or would you rather go into a natural forest? Which trees are more beautiful? The perfect ones in the plantation, or the damaged ones in a natural forest? So if you are imperfect, if you are damaged goods, then you belong to the group of perfect trees in the beautiful forest. Welcome. That's nice, being damaged goods. Alas, you belong. My partner is supportive of my being here, but he is also unwell. I know it was a big deal for him to let me come. It is a big deal for me to leave him and also be here. It is not easy to forget and cease worrying about him. Even though I too am in great need of this retreat, I feel guilty about leaving and even a bit guilty about forgetting him and being happy at peace here. Okay, it's really complicated. No, it's wonderful. Now, sometimes when you give a person an opportunity, you know, to give you, you know, the chance to be on retreat, it makes him really happy. Yeah, people are unwell, but sometimes if you do a really good deed, like, you know, say to your wife, go off, you can go on retreat, it's okay. Then that nice karma has its result. You get well and you get better as a result. Sometimes sickness is very, very strange. I remember when I was a student, I was living in a house full of other students, and it was in the north of England, and I was just had a terrible flu. You know, and my nose was dripping all sorts of yucky gunk, and my eyes were also streaming, and I felt terrible. And you know, even though I liked my studies, that day no way was I going to go into the university. I just lay in bed feeling like death. And as I was just feeling terrible, just waiting for the minutes to go past, you know, trying to sort of hope for this flu would pass and so I could get back to normal again, I felt absolutely terrible, depressed, hopeless. The doorbell was rung by somebody and they just wouldn't give up. So I staggered up in my pajamas. I just crawled to the door and opened it. What do you want? And it was a delivery man. And the man was delivering something for me. It was in the days before iPods, the days before Walkmans. It was a hi-fi player. A record player with the amplifier and speakers, which I'd sent up from London. And I was excited. I could now play my records. And so, I said thank you, signed the thing, and took all this heavy stuff up to my room, unpacked it, put it all together, and by the time I put my first record on, which happened to be Jimi Hendrix, I noticed something very strange. The snot had stopped coming out of my nose. There was no water in my eyes. I felt very good. The cold had completely gone. Just in about 5 minutes, in the excitement and happiness of just, you know, getting a hi-fi player and putting on the first piece of music, it had totally vanished. Sometimes happiness, joy, can actually get rid of all these sicknesses. So if you're sick, if you've got some terrible flu, some terrible disease, like you had, lots of nuns had flu in Dhammasara, you should have listened to Jimi Hendrix. that would have cured you. Seven of you were sick. Seven, that's what you should have done, for goodness sake. You should have asked me and I'd have sent something. But you can see just how happiness can overcome sicknesses. And it's, I think, did you, there was supposed to be a book about, say, Patch Adams, that's right, about a doctor who would go through the hospital dressed up as a fairy, doing jokes, and just to make people laugh in the hospital. And people started to get better as a result. So sometimes don't underestimate the power of happiness and joy and fun to get rid of sicknesses. I mean, there is a reason for it. When you laugh, when you get happy, and what's it called? Endorphins get secreted into the bloodstream. It's an immune increaser and it takes away your pain. And so it actually gets the body more healthy. And it's been well known that that happens. So your partner's sick. But if he thinks, wow, I've given my wife this wonderful opportunity to have this great retreat, it'll bring him so much happiness, who knows, that might get rid of his sickness. So always think in the positive side. Don't feel guilty. You need this. And if you were at home with him, you probably get sick too. And that's the two of you in trouble. At least there's only one sick. And you're here healthy. So I think it's very good that people actually have this wonderful support of allowing you to be here. It's a great thing which the partner has done, and it means that that will give him good karma, make him happy, and the sickness will probably be much, much better by the time you get home. Dear Ajahn, I feel the need for the support and approval of others before I can put myself first. Otherwise, I feel a sense of guilt. Please comment. Oh my goodness. If everybody puts everybody else first, then no one goes first. One of the monks, his sister was giving birth this evening. So he's now, we don't call them, if you're a monk and you know you have a sister who gives birth, you're not an uncle, we call them monkles. So he's now a monkle. But, you know, she was overdue for 3 or 4 days. So just wondering when they're going to give birth. So I told this old story, which, you know, which I read in England. You know, that England, people are very, very polite. At least they used to be in the old days. They'd open doors for you. They'd get up on a bus and let a pregnant woman sit down. And then they'd always say, you know, you go first. They were very, very polite. And this was such a woman, a traditional English lady from a very high-class family. And when she became pregnant, she didn't really say too much about it because it wasn't the polite thing in those days, you know, to talk about your pregnancy. And when it got to 9 months, she didn't give birth. 9.5 months, 10 months, she still hadn't given birth. So instead of complaining, she just kept a stiff upper lip. Another year, 2 years, 3 years, and you know, she just forgot about it, just gone on with life. And after 30 years since the pregnancy, she had an operation, just a simple operation, I think appendix or something. And so when they opened her up, they found a reason why she hadn't given birth, because she had had twins. And there were these two now fully developed English gentlemen, you know, in nice suits, bowler hats and furled umbrellas. And they were talking. They were saying, after you, John. No, no, I insist, after you. No, 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 after you. No, no, you first. That's why English twins always get born very late. That's only a joke. But someone has to go first. So, out of compassion for everybody else, I'm going to go first. Need to get it started. So you need the support and approval of others. Okay, you've got the support and approval of others, so you can actually go first. And the sense of guilt, that's a terrible thing. We don't do guilt in Buddhism. There's no such thing as guilt in Buddhism. If you want to go for guilt, go and join one of these other religions. Especially if you're a woman and you like guilt, go and become a Christian. Because women are supposed to be guilty. You did the first sin. You made Adam eat the apple. Your fault. That's a crazy teaching. So, look, we don't do guilt at all. Guilt is self-punishment. I'm bad, therefore I can't put myself first, I can't do anything good. No, we don't do guilt. If you've done anything wrong, you acknowledge it first of all. Bring it up so that, you know, you're being honest of your faults. Just like the trees in the forest, remember, there's not a perfect tree. You bring it up, you forgive it, which is the opposite of guilt. And you learn from it. Learning means, you know, you actually grow. When it's guilt, you are stunted. You can't grow at all. It's like putting this big rock on top of the flower. It can never grow. That's what guilt is. So you do not need to be guilty. In most of the retreats I've done here, that to make it very clear that you can, you know, be happy, you don't need to feel guilty, you don't need the support and approval of others. that doesn't work, so at least I can give my support and my approval. So we got them somewhere here. I can print it out for you if you like. It's called a happiness license. So because people respect me and they think I have authority, I print out a happiness license which says something like, I, Ajahn Brahm, hereby grant to, you know, whoever it is wants it, and I write their name very neatly, permission to be happy for any reason or no reason in particular, at any time until the coming of Maitreya Buddha, that you can be happy whenever you want. And I sign it and date it as well. And I usually try and get it on sort of letterhead. So you can carry that around with you. You can put it in your bedroom so you have permission to be happy. Sign, Ajahn Brahm. Just like, you know, you need a license to drive. You need a license to get married. You need licenses for everything in this world. So I now give you a happiness license. But when I first started doing that, people actually complained and said, well, do I have to be happy? All these people being happy, it just drives you crazy. So for that person, I did another type of license. And I called it the grumpy license. So I said, I, Ajahn Brahmawangsa, hereby grant to this person named underneath permission to be grumpy for any reason or no reason in particular, any time of the day, night, until the coming of Maitreya Buddha, signed Ajahn Brahm, dated. So you can, even if you feel grumpy, it's okay to be grumpy. Don't feel guilty about being grumpy. And you give yourself permission to be happy. So you can have two licenses if you like. So now you've got my approval. So you can put yourself first. Dear Ajahn, how does one develop confidence when they feel undeserving of opportunities in life? Is this the same person? How do I overcome the emotional pain of I'm not good enough? Need for support and approval before I put myself first. Develop confidence when they feel undeserving of opportunities in life. Gee, there must be some sickness going around. The negative mind sickness. Oh, come on. Develop confidence. One way of developing confidence is just having fun. Cracking more jokes. Being more playful. Because when you're playful, then you don't really think about yourself. You know, you're just having fun. A lot of times that is because people think far too much. And then they get into negative thinking. They think, I'm undeserving. I don't deserve this. I'm hopeless. No one likes me. It reminds me of the other story of this guy who had no confidence. And it meant that he could never find a partner in life. Every time he went to speak to a nice girl, she would turn away. And the poor man was so lonely. And so he went to see one of his friends. And his friend said, look, number one, look at yourself in a mirror. Your hairstyle. It's just disgusting. Your teeth stink. And look at the way you dress. No girl would like to go out with someone like you. So look, if you really want to find a partner in life, just, you know, go to a good dentist and get your teeth straightened. It's not that funny. Go to one of these personality coaches. You know, you can actually encourage you how to talk to, you know, people for the other gender. And then go to an expensive hairdresser. Get your hair styled properly, for goodness sake. You know, go and learn how to dance or whatever it is. And get a decent clothes to wear. You know, groom yourself. And so he took all that advice on board. You know, he went to a personality coach. Cost a fortune. And just getting his teeth straightened, that cost a lot of money too. And when all that was done, he took some dance classes. You know, he had the confidence from the personality coach. He bought himself a very expensive suit. Got a really good snazzy hairdo. And he went out for the first night to a singles bar. You know what happened? Just before he went in, he got hit by a truck and killed. And he was really upset. When he went up to heaven, he was really, really upset. What did you do that to me for? I spent all this money with a personality coach. It cost a lot of money getting my teeth straightened. I wasted all that time. He never gave me one day. And God said to him, he said, I don't believe in God, but you have to put God in, otherwise the joke doesn't work. And God said, I'm terribly sorry. It's just a mistake. We didn't recognize you. It was an old joke. It was an old joke, it was a good one. So we don't need to go to a personality coach, because the other, and this is a little bit of a funny story, but it's actually profound. And it was that somebody told me this when I was young, and it really made a difference to my confidence. And they said to me that, you know, when you're in your 20s, and this was so true, that you're really concerned what other people think of you. And which means, you know, you really try to dress, you know, appropriately. You try and learn the right way to speak, what other people of that age speak, and do the things which other people do of that age, you know, out of peer pressure, because you really are very, very concerned what other people think of you. When you get to be 30 or 40 years of age, you know, you get your self-confidence, and you don't care what other people think of you. You just dress like you want to, speak like you want to. You don't care how you come across. You've been there, done that. So in your 40s, you don't care what other people think of you. In your 20s, you really care what people think of you. When you get to my age, your 60s, you realize that people weren't thinking about you anyway. They were only thinking about themselves. If you could only realize that when you were young, you'd have a much better life. And it was so true. And I tell this thing to the young kids going out looking for a partner in life. And they think, oh, you know, see a nice girl. What am I going to say to her? How am I going to speak? You know what she's thinking? Oh, what am I going to say to him? No one is thinking of themselves. No one is thinking of you. They're thinking of themselves. So you can just go along and say anything. They're not listening to you. What am I going to say to him? Understanding that means you can just say whatever you like, because they're not listening. And then you have confidence in your life. Dear Ajahn, thank you for the simple guidance. This is meditation. Amazing, we're on a meditation retreat, not a psychotherapy conference. Thank you for the simple guidance. When I'm in the present moment, the mind goes to the past or the future. By the time I realized it, had another few thoughts, one after the other. I show kindness and welcome my mind back. How can I catch it quicker? Any tricks? It's after a while, the mindfulness gets stronger and stronger, and you can start seeing the mind start moving away from the present moment. But instead of trying to catch it once it's moved, why not find out why it moves in the first place? Why does the mind wander off? Now, how long do you meditate for? Maybe half an hour, maybe an hour at the most. How long does a movie last for? Hour and a half, 2 hours? Does your mind wander off into the past or the future when you're watching a movie? You're watching a movie, Harry Potter, and then you're thinking about something. Oh, come back again, I've got to watch Harry Potter. No! You focus on the movie without any effort. Your mind never wanders away. If you Sri Lankans are watching a cricket match, you know, you're totally focused. If you're watching a soccer match or you're watching, you know, whatever you like to watch on the TV, you're totally focused without any effort. Why is that? Because it's enjoyable, that's why. If you could only put some joy into the present moment, be kind to it, make it joyful, make it fun, then the mind wouldn't wander in the first place. So part of the trick of meditation, I've been mentioning this more and more, is to put more fun into this moment. So in other words, you know, be kind to it, just listen to it, see the funny side of things. Even if you like, don't just always meditate in the same place, in the same posture. Turn around and meditate backwards. Go on, turn around and just face the other direction. Or whatever else. Why do you always have to put your hands in your lap like this? Put your hands on your head the next time you meditate. Do something different. And I guarantee that you will actually do much, much, much better. We're talking just at tea time at Bodhinyana Monastery. When you do walking meditation, don't just do walking meditation the same way every time. Now, I've never seen this, but someone said that Michael Jackson does this moonwalk where it looks like he's walking forward, but he ends up walking backwards. Is that true? Okay, do moonwalk, walking meditation, like Michael Jackson. Why not? Try it. Give it a try. Because you will find when you put fun into it, it's very easy to focus. You don't get bored. Later on, the joy will come in the meditation by itself. But now we're going to just put a little bit more happiness into the meditation. And then you find the mind doesn't wander away at all. The only reason why it wanders away is because you're not happy where you are. You want to be somewhere else. That's the only reason. So yeah, you can catch it and bring it back, catch it and bring it back, catch it and bring it back. But that gets very frustrating after a while. The best way is actually to be happy in this moment. Do a little marketing campaign. Just think, you don't have a partner and a kid to look after. For 8 days, you are free. You don't have to go to work. You don't have to face your boss. You don't have to work at a stupid computer which never works properly. You don't know telephone calls you have to keep answering. You got no dog next door which keeps barking. You are totally free. You don't have to go shopping. You don't have to do anything. You know, the food is cooked for you. You just do a tiny little bit of work and that's all. You're so free. Just imagine just what's happening here. And then you think, wow, this is great. I'm on holiday. This is why we don't call it a meditation retreat. What do we call this place? It's not Jhana Grove. What's its real name? Club Med Perth. Club Meditation Perth. Club Med. Which means you can enjoy being here. When you appreciate being here, the mind doesn't wander off. See if you can develop a bit more happiness in this moment. Even by doing a few funny things. Get a teddy bear and put it in your lap. And then you find it's much easier to be here. It's more fun, more joy. So that's actually how to do that one. Could you please explain the ritual's blessing performed as you enter the meditation room and leave? I'm not a Buddhist, but would like to honor and give thanks in the appropriate way if this is the meeting. There are no rituals in Buddhism. So when you see me, you can either do this and say, hi, Brahm. And I'll be happy no matter what you do. Because sometimes the rituals are sometimes something which hides Buddhism. And the rituals can be so thick that sometimes you can't even understand what the teachings are. One of my friends, I've done quite a few talks with him, he's a professor of physics at the University of Western Australia, Professor David Blair. And I've talked to him many, many times, and he said he was really interested in Buddhism when he was a young man. He went to Thailand to try and find out more about Buddhism and meditation. He went into many temples, but all he saw was the rituals. He could never find anyone who could tell him what meditation was or what Buddhism was teaching. All he saw was chanting and bowing and putting incense into containers. And I told him, and it was a very wonderful metaphor, he said he couldn't see the Buddha for the incense smoke. You know, in other words, the rituals totally hid what Buddhism was. Which is one of the reasons that we try and keep the rituals to a bare minimum at all. You can bow when you come in here if you want to. As long as you know why you are bowing. And you know the reason why you bow? Because scientists have proved, someone gave me the report about 6 months ago, every time you bow, your brain secretes nitrous oxide, otherwise known as laughing gas. It makes you happy every time you bow. It is actually a natural high. So try it. Bow, bow, bow. Yes, it's good. Bow. Yes. That's why Buddhists are happy, because they bow so much. That's what scientists say. But personally, when I bow to a Buddha statue, I don't bow to a lump of metal. That's all that is, a lump of metal. And the Buddha never looked like that. He never had a pointed sort of punk hairdo like that. But that's just the image. But it's what it represents. So when I bow to a Buddha, the first time I put my head down, I am worshipping virtue. Because virtue, goodness, trustworthiness is really important. I've seen just its importance in my life and other people's life. So I remember virtue. For me, it's my precepts as a monk. So when I bow down to a Buddha, it's as if I'm raising that virtue even higher. And I'm reminding myself, my precepts, my virtue is really, really important. So it makes me keep those precepts even stronger. And the second time I bow down to stillness, to peace. Because that, not just in meditation, but harmony, you know, in the monastery, harmony in the Buddhist society, harmony in the family, harmony in the country. That peace, that stillness, again, is incredibly important. And it's so important I can let many, many things go for the sake of harmony, for peace. So I bow down to that. I remind myself of its importance. And the last time I bow down to kindness, compassion. Because that also, every time I see a kind act, it just makes the world a beautiful place to live in. So I bow down to those three things. Virtue, peace, and compassion. And it makes it so easy for me to bow down to that. And I realize that I'm remembering those three things every time I bow down, which means that I never forget them, they get stronger in my life. So the act of bowing has enormous meaning, and it makes those qualities grow stronger in me. So they become a practice whereby I do become more virtuous, more peaceful, more kind. So it's reminding me of its importance. That's why I bow. So you can try that if you wish. When you come into the room, bow down to the image of a Buddha. But it's only remembering, bowing down to virtue, peace, and compassion. And then it's a ritual which does have meaning. So many rituals, you ask these Buddhists, what do you do that for? And people just don't know. Recently I was in Penang, and if ever you go to Asia, you find that people in, you know, Chinese Buddhism, same in Korea, when they get their incense and they put it in the big incense burner, they go shaking it first of all. Have you seen that, shaking the incense before they put it in the incense burner? Where did that ritual come from? You know, I am an intelligent monk, and I know where that ritual came from. Because I know that in Asian countries, it's your grandma takes you to the temple first of all. That's her job. You know, in Thailand, it's the same. Grandma takes you to the temple first of all. And grandma shows you what to do. And grandma shows you how to put incense into the incense container. And when grandma puts incense in, she does this, and all the children follow. But the only reason grandma does that, because she is so old, she's got Parkinson's disease. And the kids think, oh, that's what we should do as well. And from that is why people, Chinese Buddhists, always shake the incense before they put it in. That's all it is. So some of the rituals which you have, just when you actually find out, you know, where they came from, they're not necessary at all. So if you know what the ritual is, it does have a meaning, then fine, do it. So that's the rituals and blessing when you enter the meditation room and leave. Just do a bow. Can the air con please be turned on? People's body odor is becoming obvious. Thank you. It has been turned on, but I think it just recycles the air in this room, so it gets worse and worse. So look, the best thing to do, especially, did you have baked beans for breakfast? If anyone has baked beans for breakfast, please sit in the back. Not in the front, because if you're sitting in the front, all the people behind you will have to suffer. No, there's plenty of water over there, so you can just have enough showers. But then again, when it's very sweaty, sometimes a body odor does come out. But that's good. You know, one person's body odor is another person's scent. Why are people just so fault-finding with body odor? A dog is just such a wonderful example of a good, kind, compassionate, wise being. You know, every odor, the stronger, the more interesting it is. And that's, dogs never complain body odor. Body odor is really cool. So I don't care, whatever. So if that doesn't work, you know, get some tissue paper, stuff it up your nose. So no one, you don't know what other people are smelling like. So that's the least of your problems, body odor. But if you really don't like it, go and sit in your room. And if body odour still bothers you in your own room, you know where it's coming from. Next question. As I fear the public speaking aspect of my work, I'm tempted to leave and therefore avoid it. Are such fear a result of karma, a teaching to be faced and learned from? It's a sense of not... Well, it's karma, because all karma is like opportunities. So you've got a nice opportunity to actually to learn what you're afraid of. Now, if it's at work, you know, a lot of times you're giving a presentation, and these are, most of them are your friends anyway, you know, they're egging you on. And if you make a mistake while you're giving a presentation, what do you do when everybody starts laughing? You laugh as well. And then the world never laughs at you. It only laughs with you. So this is how to do public speaking. You just, it's amazing. Just you see a couple of people talking over around a cup of coffee on a table, and they can speak for hours. There's no difference between doing a public speaking and just having a chat with somebody. Because when I give a public talk, that's what I'm doing, having a chat with my friends. I'm having fun, having a few jokes, saying a few interesting stuff. Hopefully. If it's not, fine. I'm interested. Don't care about you. That's why I always laugh at my own jokes. What's my favourite joke, which I keep laughing at? See if I can actually tell this whole joke this time. You know, that's the carrot joke. You know, how many of you have not heard the carrot joke? Put your hand up. Now you have heard it before, Sweeney. Keep your precepts. I don't care, you've heard it, you haven't heard it, I'm going to tell it. So this is our public speaking. You don't care what the audience thinks. Two carrots walking down the road. One gets hit by a car, and the other one gets out his cell phone, calls the ambulance straight away. Now over here, 000. Ambulance comes within 2 or 3 minutes, looks at the injured carrot, puts it straight in the back of the ambulance, and with his friend also in the ambulance, they rush to the hospital. In the hospital, straight into triage, where the nurse took one look at the injured carrot and said, "This is serious. We're going to have to take them into emergency surgery." And so they wheel the injured carrot into surgery. And if ever you've been in a hospital in the emergency department, you know how tense the atmosphere is. Here's your friends and relations waiting in the waiting room, not knowing if their loved one is going to live or die. It's one of the most electric atmospheres you could ever go to. And after 2 hours, the doctor comes in to the waiting room, recognizes, you know, the carrot, said, "Oh, you're the friend of the injured carrot inside. Dead giveaway." Said, yes, how is he? And the doctor said, "I have some good news and some bad news. The good news is we've managed to keep him alive. he's going to pull through. Oh, thank goodness, says his friend Mr. Carroll. What's the bad news? And the bad news, says the doctor, I can never do this without laughing. The bad news is, because of his injuries, he's going to be a vegetable for the rest of his life. I love that joke, even if you've heard it 100 times. I'm always going to tell it. And that's how to do public speaking. You don't care what other people think. You just go ahead and do it. And that's the public speaking aspect of my work. So just enjoy what you're doing. Then you come across at the very least as confident. You come across as a little bit entertaining. Because if you're having fun, everyone else has fun. If you have enthusiasm, everyone else has enthusiasm. That is really what you're speaking. So it's not that hard to do. Just actually just enjoy yourself. Dear Ajahn, what is the difference between Anapanasati and Satipatthana? There is no difference at all. You look in Sutta 118 of the Majjhima Nikaya. There you will find the Buddha said verbatim, anyone who practices the 16 steps of Anapanasati thereby fulfills, completes the four Satipatthanas. That is the word of the Buddha. This is no joke. I actually do know some Buddhism. And this is verse 1, this is the 118th Sutra, the Anapanasati Sutra. He said there's no difference at all. Anapanasati is one way of doing Satipatthana. When is a suitable time to practice the 32 parts of the body? Thank you very much. The 32 parts of the body are just looking at the body, dissecting it in your mind into all its different parts, just as a way of overcoming especially lust. So if you've seen, you girls seen a really hot boy on this retreat. Now it happens sometimes. I was on teaching this retreat a couple of years ago, and on the interview time, interview, you're supposed to be asking talks about meditation. Now this young girl said, no, that hunky guy, he was actually a Norwegian guy, that hunky guy, has he got a partner? You know. That's what they asked me. I said, actually, yes, he met his partner on the retreat the year before. I said, oh, that sucks, he's so hot. And that was the end of the interview. So it does happen sometimes. So this is not just, you know, that's what happens in Club Med, singles club. Anyway, so if you really see someone you like, you know, and you've already got a partner, you know, your husband is sick back home or something. 32 parts of the body. Yeah, what you're doing, it's just skin and hair, that's all. That's what we do as monks, as a novice monk, the ordination of a novice monk. We do the first five of the 32 parts of the body. Hair of the body, hair of the head, nails, teeth and skin. And if you don't know why you do that, it's because those are the external parts of the body. That's what you see. And if you see that, you realize hair of the body, hair of the head, it's all dead stuff. Because the roots which are alive are under the skin and you cannot see it. All the hair I'm looking at now is all dead. Teeth, that's all dead. The roots are underneath, you cannot see them. Nails, more dead stuff. Because underneath, now hidden under the skin under here somewhere, that's where the live part of the nails are. And your skin, that's also dead stuff. Because the live stuff is about a millimeter under the surface. Outside it's all dead stuff. So, if Angelina Jolie walked into this room, what do you see? If Justin Bieber came in, all I see, dead hair, dead skin, dead teeth, dead nails, yuck. Who would want to dead stuff? No way. So that's what to do. And so that's why it works. And it just gets rid of this fantasy stuff. And it does work because there's one of the members, remember Judy Rushforth? She went to go and see His Holiness the Dalai Lama over in India a few years ago. And when she went to, if you go to there in Dharamsala, you can stay there, and they've got places you can stay. And they make an appointment. But in the morning, they've got a hall, you can do some meditation in the morning. She was a meditator, she went there in the morning, sat down, started watching her breath, and then after 5 minutes, someone sat next to her, and that was the end of her meditation. Richard Gere. No, come on, watch the breath. Richard Gere. She couldn't help herself. Now that would be the time to do 32 parts of the body. Richard Gere, just dead hair, dead skin, dead sea, yuck. Anyway, that's where to do it. Gee, big question. Here we go. Hi, lovely master. Sorry for my English grammar and sorry for the long question. Maybe you prefer to take the question to the end of the retreat and Dharma talks. It's okay. Anyway, I listened one time a Dharma talk of yours called Deep Insight, which the Ajahn said we need to contemplate the four Satipatthanas in Upachara post jhana. I think that this instruction appears perfectly in the 38th Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya and in the Chapana Sutta from the Anguttara. There's a passage in Sutta that describes this practice, contemplation of the four Satipatthanas almost together. With the contemplation of the body well established and with a limited luminous mind. He, the meditator, doesn't have aversion to disagreeable, painful objects or senses or mental objects, and doesn't have craving to the agreeable, pleasurable objects, and undusted with wisdom the things really are anicca, dukkha, anatta. Okay, I'll just describe what's happened there. It's one of the jobs of the deep meditations, one of the jobs of meditation, I haven't sort of gone that far in meditation yet to teach you this, is actually to get so still and so happy and satisfied that all desires and all aversion just become suppressed. That's the job of the jhanas, to do that, to actually suppress the five hindrances. Well, the problem is that when we have any desire or ill will, we tend to see what we want to see, and we hide what we don't like to see. And now those are one of the reasons why we can't see the truth of things. Now, what is agreeable to us, what is pleasing to us, that's the only thing we see. And if you really want to see the truth, you have to get rid of all desire and all aversion to see what's truly there. Even if it's shocking to you, even if it's not what you expect, even if it's embarrassing, humiliating, whatever. You have to have such a commitment to truth. Whatever it is, whether I like it or not, I'm going to face it. And that means all desire has to be suppressed and all aversion has to be suppressed. And that's actually what they're doing here. So in 38th Sutta we have a sequence, Anupubhikata, that's a sequence, that's what it means. You get rid of the five hindrances, which means you get the jhanas, and this contemplation I indicated happens. Then you abandon craving, you abandon the fuel, you abandon... you're abandoning the craving, you abandon the fuel, and then the process of existence, birth, and the resultant old age and death. That's dependent origination. I understand the meditator is able to see with wisdom because of upaka, viveka, and suppression of nivarana, because of jhanas. It's a duty, it's a delusion that this dry insight of some people teaching. Okay, am I right? Some people say you don't need jhanas to get deep insight into the nature of things. And they call this dry insight sukha vipassika. But nowadays you can just get all the teachings of the Buddha online, and you can do a word search, Dry Insight, Sukha Vipassaka. How many times does it appear in the suttas, and where does it appear in the suttas? And you find it doesn't appear at all in the suttas, the word of the Buddha. It's not there. It comes from the commentaries, which were written down 1,000 years after the Buddha. It is not the word, the teaching of the Buddha. And it's great that people know that, see that for themselves. Because as they say here, the teaching of the Buddha is abandon the 5 hindrances, attain these jhanas, which I'll be talking about later on, and as a result of attaining the jhanas, then the insights happen. You do need the jhanas to get the deep insights which make you enlightened. There's no other way. So it is a delusion, this way of dry insight. It doesn't happen. It's impossible without the jhanas. Exactly. But I'll say more about that later on. Hi Ajahn, what is the reason for bowing to the Buddha? Is this not elevating Buddha to the status of a god, or giving that impression? I've already answered that. You're not bowing to the Buddha. I was once invited to give a talk at a Christian school in Perth, Christ Church Grammar School. It's one of the top Christian schools here in Perth. And it was, you know, the morning assembly. So, you know, I knew the pastor there, Frank Sheehan, is a good mate. And so he invited me, why don't you come and give the assembly one morning? So I got there, and we had to wait outside the principal, the chaplain, and me, while all the kids in the school sort of settled down into the assembly. And then we would come in procession. And the principal told me, he said, when we come in, there's a little shrine to Jesus Christ. He said, now the chaplain and I will bow to that shrine, but you're a Buddhist, you don't need to bow. And at that I took my opportunity and argued with him. I say, I demand my right to bow to your statue of Jesus. And just like, when you say things like that, it's great to look at his face. Because people get really confused. What do you mean? You're a Buddhist. You know you're not supposed to bow. So why not? Because just like when I bow to a Buddha statue, I bow to virtue, peace and compassion. And I can see something in that image which I respect. And that is what I'm going to bow to. And, you know, he was really impressed with that. You're not bowing because you're a Christian. You're bowing because there's something there which you can find which is worthy of bowing to. And that's what I did. You know that later on he came to visit Bodhinyana Monastery with the kids, the principal. And they went into my cave, my famous cave, over later on. So, I mean, that's actually what you do for bowing. It's actually showing, it's always you can find respect, something to respect in everything. And straight away, I gave him a really deep teaching of how we can respect each other in other religions, and also what bowing is all about. It's not bowing because it's a duty you do, because you're a Buddhist, you have to bow to the Buddha, but you can't bow to Jesus Christ. So no, that's not what it's all about. Bowing is finding something to respect in that object. That is why, like, you know, Sri Lanka, you bow to your parents. And amazing, imagine that, trying to encourage that in Australia. The kids, your sons and daughters, to bow to the parents. Would that happen? Would it happen in Brazil? You bow to your parents? No way! Unless you find something worth bowing to. And if you find something worth bowing to, you realize why you're doing it. You know, you're bowing to the generosity, you know, the commitment, the kindness, whatever it is. Now, if you find something worth bowing to, it's so easy to do. It's not just a ceremony anymore. It's something which is beautiful, it has meaning. And of course, it's not common in a culture like Australia to bow to anyone, let alone your parents. But it's one of the most beautiful ceremonies when we do an ordination here. Like, Muda, you ordained, not how long ago?
A couple of weeks ago.
Is your mum still here? Yes, she is. You bow to your mum?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, beautiful, isn't it? Yeah. So he bowed to his mum. And isn't it nice to see that? Especially, you know, well, he's not really a young man anymore, but, you know. But when you see these young men ordaining and they bow to their parents, sometimes people start crying. It's such a beautiful thing to see. So anyway, dear Ajahn Brahm, if I talk with a person, the memories come back to me afterwards. This disturbance in my mind prevents me having a good conversation with another. And practicing present moment awareness may lead to overcoming my bad habits. Triple Gem bless you. My goodness. I mean, I talk to so many people, the memories don't come back to me at all. That's why some of you, because I meet so many people throughout the year, because I travel around so much, and some of you say, "Hi, Ajahn Brahm, remember me." Oh, please give me a break. Now, I saw you 4 years ago on a retreat. Since that time, I've seen another 400,000 people. So what I usually say, this is a great trick. If you're in that same situation I'm in, you're always meeting people and they say, "Do you remember me?" The trick is to tell them, "Yeah, I remember you. You're the person whose name I keep forgetting." So that gets you out of a jam. You don't have to remember their name. And number two, they feel a bit special. So that's my trick. You're the person's name. So when I talk with a person, it disappears afterwards. It doesn't disturb my mind. So please, let it go. Because a lot of time, it's not really worth remembering. It was just nice, you know, being kind to someone and listening to them and spending time with them. That's really important. But don't sort of keep anything. If the Buddha only first recollected past lives and gained knowledge of the destination of beings according to their karma on the night of his enlightenment, how did he previously know that the two attainments taught by Kalama and Ramaputta only led to rebirth in those realms? Also, if there were not two attainments, as you maintain, what rebirth did the Buddha mean, karma, jhana, arupa? Okay, this is the old chestnut, the old question of the Buddha learned under two teachers, Alala Kalama Uttaka Ramaputta, and one of them taught him, Alala Kalama taught him the base of nothingness, Uttaka Ramaputta taught him the base of neither perception nor non-perception. The Buddha said that those did not lead to enlightenment. Later on, the Buddha said the real arupa states do lead to enlightenment, so there's a conflict there, saying one thing about Alala Kalama and Uttaka Ramaputta's meditation and saying another, totally opposite, about the real arupa attainments. And the only way that you can make sense of that is to have the suggestion that what Alala Kalama and Uttaka Ramaputta taught were not the real things, like fake attainments, in name only. Just like even these days, I mean, you talk about jhanas. Jhanas are now popular. But still, some people teach some things as jhana when they're obviously not. In the United States, they call them jhana light, L-I-T-E. It's not really the real thing, but still they call it that. Just to get a little bit of happiness in meditation, that's piti sukha. That's first jhana. It's not. Jhanas are much bigger than that. But they have the same name, but it's not the real thing. You can see it happening now. So obviously that was the most sensible explanation of what Alala Kalama Uttaka Ramaputta taught. A name, but not the real thing. Because the real things actually do lead to enlightenment. And those real arupa states, which I'll talk about later hopefully, are based on the jhanas. You can't just get them without the four jhanas. Hi, can you please explain the use of the 108 meditation prayer beads? Can they be used during the retreat? If not, why not? Many thanks. Because they're so noisy. Click, 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 click. And it don't have to be 108 beads, it's just one way of trying to keep you from wandering off. So you can't go thinking, 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 because you're clicking. And as you're clicking, you're supposed to be actually reciting something. And for 108, apparently, if you do that chant, it, ti, pi, so, ba, ga, wa, a, la, hug. It's supposed to be 108 syllables. Check it tonight if you wish, and see if it's right or not. If you want to waste time. doesn't really matter, but it's supposed to be 108 syllables. In other words, it's like a rosary in Catholicism. It's just one way of trying to keep your attention focused. But there's so many other ways of keeping your attention focused without making so much noise. And so sometimes when you go into a meditation and people are being quiet, somebody gets their beads out, click, 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 click. It can be quite disturbing. So there's other ways of doing it. How do we observe our mind during meditation? And should we use our silence to observe our mind? I've just been teaching you that. How you observe your mind, first of all, you have to be in the present moment. Let go of the body, come into the present moment. That's the only place where mindfulness lives. And then you allow the mind to become that still that your five senses settle down and vanish. So you're not seeing, you're not hearing, you're not smelling, you're not tasting, you're no physical touch left. When those five senses have stopped, then the only thing left is the mind. And then you can observe the mind. It's the same as a simile which I give of the emperor. Once there was an emperor, very powerful, but no one had ever seen the emperor. They did not know whether the emperor was old or young, male or female, Caucasian, Asian, Sri Lankan, Korean, African, Brazilian, because they'd never seen him or her or whatever it was. Every time the emperor appeared, he had boots which went up beyond his knee. He had trousers which covered the top of his boots and went up to his waist. He had a jacket which overlapped the top of the trousers, with a high neck and sleeves which went down to the wrists. Had gloves which overlapped the bottom of the sleeves of the jacket, and a helmet which overlapped the top of the jacket. Those five pieces of clothing overlapping one another, so you could see nothing of the emperor inside. Just the boots, the jacket, the trousers, the gloves and the helmet. And so if you want to find out who the emperor was, you've got to take those clothings off, the five pieces of clothing, until there's nothing which is obscuring the identity of the emperor. And in that simile, the emperor is your mind. The only way you can see your mind is to undress it from these five senses, which always cover it. In other words, to see how we can let go of all seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, until there's only one thing left, the mind. And that is the job of meditation, allowing the five senses to vanish. So the only thing left is the emperor, the mind, which runs you. Anyway, I'll be saying how that happens afterwards. And now, the last question for this evening. Da da da. Dear Ajahn, please correct my false understanding that accept will only ease the pain of mind, but if may discourage and diminish our ability to improve our life to resolve the problem. Your advice most so much appreciated. To improve your life, isn't your life good enough? I spent years and years improving Bodhinyana Monastery. Now we've built Jhana Grove. I'm going to keep improving and improving this place. Will that improvement ever finish? For 30 years we've been improving Bodhinyana Monastery. Is it finished yet? Improving has no end to it. Try to get wiser, smarter, even kinder. It goes on and on and on forever. So improvement has no end. Contentment has an end. To realize one day you don't have to improve yourself anymore. You're good enough. Which means the journey of life stops. Stops right here. When you want something more, you cannot enjoy what you already have. So at the very least, stop trying to improve yourself 1 hour every day. And appreciate that you're already perfect enough. Why do you want to improve things? just more craving, more desire. So in this meditation, you're going to find you don't have to improve anything. This is good enough. I don't have to improve my jokes. You may think so, but not me. They're good enough. And that way, you can have some peace at last. Why are you trying to improve things? Why is this whole search to try and become a better person, a wiser person, a kinder person? That whole idea is just a delusion. When you stop striving, then everything which your striving promised you, you find you already have. An old Zen saying, the hungry man, he was looking for fire to light, the hungry man was looking for a flame to light the fire to cook his rice. He's looking for a flame all over the place with a candle. Where's the flame? Where's the flame? If he only knew what flame was, he would have cooked his dinner much earlier. Just like you, always looking for contentment with desire, looking for peace with struggling. If you only knew what peace and contentment was, you'd become enlightened much quicker. And you could go to bed much earlier. Okay, that's enough for this evening. So thank you for listening. It's 9:20, a bit extra this evening. So now those of you who want to carry on meditating, can carry on meditating. Those who want to go to sleep, can go to sleep. Those who don't know what they want to do,